Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Understanding Autism. I'm Kim Isaac. I'm a co-host of this radio show. And I also have Paul Loudon. He's actually calling in today. Paul, are you there?
Can you hear me all right?
Hello? Yes.
Okay.
Can you hear us? Okay,
yeah,
good.
I can hear you just fine.
Oh, I miss having you here. It's very lonely. But I'm glad you're able to call in.
Yeah.
Today we have a great guest. We have Jim Adams, Dr. Jim Adams, and he is the president of the Autism Society here in Phoenix, and he's also the director of ASU's Autism and Asperger's Research Program, and he's also the father to an adult daughter on the spectrum, and we're just so thankful to have him. He's one of our favorite guests. Jim, are you there?
Hi, Kim and Paul. Yes, I'm here. Glad to be here.
Hi. Oh, great. Oh, good. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I know there's so many new developments and research, and I know listeners are just really looking forward to hearing about what the latest is. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what's going on in research?
Well, there are a lot of different things I'd love to share with the audience. There's been some exciting new research on how to prevent autism. There's been some exciting new research on the causes of autism. And we've been in the midst of completing a major study of nutritional treatments for autism. And we've been looking at also abnormal gut bacteria in kids with autism.
Oh, wow. That is a lot. Where should we start? Prevention?
Sure.
Okay.
So there have been, if you want, there have been two major studies that show that the risk of autism can be reduced 40% if the mother takes a high dose of folic acid right around the time of conception. So taking it 1 to 2 months later is too late, but if they take the recommended amount of folic acid around the time of conception or within a month of that, they have a 40% lower chance of having a child with autism.
Wow, that's a huge number.
Yeah, it's very exciting. We've known for a long time that folic acid is important for reducing birth defects like spina bifida, but now we know that it's important for mothers to take to reduce the risk of having a child with autism. There have been several studies, including one by our group, that show that kids with autism have an increased need for folic acid, and it turns out that so do mothers, and actually so do fathers of kids with autism.
Oh, really? I didn't realize that folic acid was also for males. For some reason, I thought it was specific to females. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's an important vitamin for both. In fact, there's a standard blood test that mothers and fathers of kids with autism should all do. It's called a test of homocysteine. So it's HOMOCYSTEINE. And that's a test that can be done during an annual physical. And if levels are elevated, it means that you're at increased risk of a heart attack. And it's very easily treatable by folic acid and vitamin B12. And it turns out moms and dads of kids with autism are at increased risk.
Wow. So what did the research study look like? How did you come to these conclusions?
Well, there was one study done in Norway of 75,000 children. And of that, several hundred children developed autism. And they tracked their dietary intake of folic acid and found out that they had the ones who took a folic acid supplement had about a 40% lower risk of having a child with autism. And then there was a similar study done in California with the Mind Institute. They looked at about 470 families, kids with autism, versus about 250 typically developing kids, and they asked their mothers what their intake of folic acid was right around pregnancy. And it turns out the moms of the kids with autism had ingested slightly less folic acid at that time, and that small amount made a big difference.
Wow, that is extremely exciting, because I know that's one of the big questions on everybody's mind right now, hearing more and more about autism. I think people, you know, they have a desire to learn about what it is, but of course they're curious on what they can do health-wise, you know, to increase their chances of prevention. So that's really exciting. So how is ASU doing some kind of follow-up to that, or just using that for further research?
Well, we had published a couple studies showing that kids with autism had an increased need for folic acid and B12. And then we also showed that in our treatment study that when they took it as part of a general multivitamin supplement, it led to a variety of improvements in their functioning and behavior. And so if it was good for the children and adults with autism, for some of them, then it's very plausible that it might help prevent it. So that was our role. If we find something abnormal in the kids, the next step is to look at it in the mothers and fathers.
Right. Well, that's also interesting that you mentioned the fathers, because I hadn't heard a lot about, you know, examining more of the health of the father. It seems in the past it's always had a focus more on the mothers.
Right, because the mother has a much larger role in the environment. The child's in the mother's womb, and then even after birth, the mother's providing the milk for that child's development. So the mother's health is hugely important, but it turns out in one study done about 6 years ago by Jill James, a large study where they looked at 200 typical moms and 40 moms with autism and about 40 dads of kids with autism, they found that both the mothers and the fathers had increased levels of homocysteine and hence needed increased amount of folic acid and B12.
Wow. Paul, do you have any questions? I know it's a little bit different having you on the phone versus live, so I can't see if you're ready to jump in, but I want to give you the chance to talk. Do you have any questions or comments?
I was just listening at the moment. I was kind of wondering, you know, with this information with the folic acid, and I remember that in the past we'd had you on and you'd mentioned some other things that a mother should be aware of that they should possibly make sure that they are getting enough of. Is there a good resource for finding out what the current state is for knowing, you know, which of these things you want to have as a mother during pregnancy, other than just, you know, the standard, you know, whoever your practitioner is that you're seeing for guidance while you're pregnant to avoid conditions like this?
Yeah, it's a great question. That these two studies just came out in the last few months. So we're working, I'm working with two groups right now. One group is called the Forum, another group is called the Neurological Health Foundation, and they're both working together on a project to put information on the web for families to learn about how to prevent not just autism, but a very wide range of health problems in children through intervening early at the time of conception. And in fact, they're also working on doing some very large studies with tens of thousands of families to try to implement these and to demonstrate that we really can reduce, we think, not just risk of autism, but risk of ADHD, of asthma, of many other conditions if we intervene early.
Sir, do you know if there's been other related research to other conditions that you mentioned?
Yes, there has been. For example, vitamin D has been shown that if you take vitamin D during pregnancy, that can help decrease the risk of miscarriage, which is important, and also decrease the risk of a premature birth. And if a child is born prematurely, that increases their risk for a whole wide range of mental and physical health problems. And so that alone seems like a very simple and safe thing to do.
So you recommended the homocysteine test for people to go do. Do you have any other recommendations of tests that for listeners that are, you know, interested in prevention and, you know, they want to present some things to their doctors? Can you suggest any other kinds of tests that are pretty simple to do?
Well, there's one other treatment that can be done. It's not really a test, but it turns out that spacing children apart, so waiting at least 12 months after the birth of a child before conceiving another, can help reduce the risk of autism. That if the second child is conceived within 12 months of the birth of the first, that's about a 3 times higher risk of having a child with autism. So just spacing the children out, 2 years is better, but at least 1 year is good to reduce the risk. It just seems
that's
we don't
so
know for sure the reason why, but we think that, you know, imagine even after birth, the mother is still nursing usually and giving up a lot of nutrients to their child, so we think mother's body just needs time to recover.
That makes a lot of sense, kind of replenish the resources that the body needs.
Yeah, some people like to have their children close together so they can play better together, but from a health perspective, it seems we need to wait a year or two.
Right, and 2 years is still a pretty close age difference, so, you know, you
absolutely
can still have kids that can be playmates. But, Paul, do you have anything else you want to say about this this topic of prevention?
Not really. I mean, it's interesting to me, mainly in the sense that it reinforces the idea that autism is a physical thing, because, you know, there's so many people out there who still don't really understand autism, and it's hard to talk with them about it. And having this information on hand as someone on the spectrum saying, you know, look, autism is one of those things that it's a physical disability. It doesn't just go away if you try hard enough. You know, that there are things that need to be addressed in a physical sense. If you can point to the fact that, you know, that autism starts before birth with the nutrition and health of the mother, you can much more easily reinforce the idea when trying to explain it to people that it's more than just, you know, just thought processes. And so, you know, while, you know, obviously this question of the health of a mother, not really directly relevant to me personally at my point in life, it's still really interesting to me as knowledge that can help explain autism to other people.
That's a really good point, Paul. I know I'm thinking of, you know, of you and other adults, and I know sometimes, you know, adults get kind of a hard time from people on the outside, especially ones that have a lot of skills, you know, that are very verbal and articulate, and you know, from the outside they look like they should just be able to do everything, you know, that we're doing. And so I know that sometimes people say, oh, it's just all in your head, you're just not trying enough, you know, but to be reminded that there are actual biomedical, you know, things happening in the body, I mean, I would think that would be a huge point of interest and maybe even a relief for you to be able to have something to share with others about your autism.
Well, there's also just the simple fact that there are people out there still who believe that autism doesn't exist, and it's really how to start introducing the idea to them that it's not just parents who didn't raise their kids the right way is challenging, and being able to have this research, this biomedical backup, really helps with that.
Yeah, it does. Jim, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think you're right that autism is very much an invisible disability. You can look at someone and they can seem to be, they may look physically okay, but they may still have a lot of challenges that can be confusing for people outside. And so I think that, again, just shows that this is not due to bad parenting, as people thought 50 years ago, but this is a biological condition, and we need to recognize that so we can better help people with it and hopefully accept them better too.
And also just understanding, I just want to throw in the note of, you know, behavior, because a lot of times people sometimes get hyper-focused on behavior when it comes to autism. But if you think about it, someone's not feeling well, you know, they're not healthy, and, you know, maybe they either can't express how they're feeling inside regarding their health or energy, or, you know, or even if they can express and they don't know any different, you know, they don't know what healthy even feels like. You know, it's just a good reminder for people to look at the bigger picture and not just the behavior, not just the diagnosis or, you know, things like that, to really approach, you know, treatment from a very balanced perspective.
And we got a question on our Facebook page while we were talking here. We have Rob Baer, who wants to know how genetics and inherited autistic traits are affected by diet and nutrition. So I guess he's asking perhaps whether, you know, genetic traits or diet and nutrition are the more significant risk factors, and whether nutrition can be sort of a mitigation to the risk factors that come with having a genetic predisposition in the parents towards autism.
Yeah, there's no doubt that both genetics and the environment are involved. The largest study of identical twins done in California with close to 200 twins found that genetics accounted for around 35% of autism and environmental factors about 60% of autism, roughly. So both are important. Let's just stick with that example, folic acid. It turns out that some of the mothers in the California study, some of the mothers had a particular defect in their metabolism of folic acid. And when they have this particular defect, then they're at much higher risk if they aren't getting enough folic acid. So the need for folic acid depends to some extent, and if you have this genetic defect is too strong a word, but polymorphism, a difference where your enzyme just doesn't work quite as well as other people's, and if you get plenty of folic acid, you'll be okay, but you need more than the average person.
Jim, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, okay. So I thought we lost you.
Yeah. So I hope that sort of explains how. Yeah. So I hope that explains how both the genetics and environment make a difference. That you can have these genetic polymorphisms, but you can overcome them in some cases by, in this case, increased amounts of folic acid. Let's turn to, if you want, one of the other subjects, which is the one of the new pieces of research on the causes of autism, that there is a study out by a group at UC Davis where they've been checking mothers' immune systems. And they'd reported that about 11% of autism moms had antibodies where their mother's immune system would attack the infant's developing brain. But in their latest study, they found four additional antibodies. So now they find that about 23% of autism mothers, their immune system is going awry and it's attacking, producing antibodies to attack fetus's brain. And there have been animal studies where they take those antibodies, put them into pregnant mice, and find out that those the offspring of those mice develop abnormally. So we don't know how to treat it yet. We don't know why the mother's immune system is going awry, but it's an important clue that, again, is getting us closer to understand why some people develop autism. So some cases, not enough folic acid. Some case, the mother's immune system is going awry.
Wow, that's really interesting. This topic is so interesting to me because I know in my world as a therapist, I am focused on supporting the families and, you know, that sort of thing. And I forget to really, you know, look into all this amazing research. It gives me a lot of hope and it's very exciting. And, you know, let's just take a short break. And when we come back, we'll continue our discussion talking about the latest autism research. Okay, we'll be right back.
Birenbaum and Spien PC, we want to help you work on your business, not in your business. we take a simple approach. You know your business. Our firm gives you the information to make those decisions better. Our firm takes a proactive approach to your accounting needs, and if you look behind the numbers, you'll find there are hidden opportunities that we try to impart on you. Communication is the key to that understanding, and there is no charge for brief phone calls. Contact us at 602-266-5633 or email us at mitch@jfbpc.com. Birenbaum and Spean works to increase your understanding of your business in order to make the decisions necessary to move your business forward.
Ridenour, Heitzen & Lewis is a multi-practice law firm, ideally equipped to assist with a broad range of legal and business issues, corporate and financial transactions, real estate, commercial, litigation, bankruptcy, and private client practice. Ridenour, Heitzen & Lewis is a law firm that bases its practice on understanding the businesses of their clients, and they use this insight to meet each client's unique and evolving legal challenges. Call or click today, 602-254-9900. Find them on the web at rhkl-law.com.
Do you owe money to the IRS? Have you heard of possible payment options such as a partial payment installment agreement, offering compromise, or not currently collectible status? Knowing that you have options and what those options are will greatly relieve your worry and stress. Hi, my name is Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. If you are curious as to what options may be available to you if you owe money to the IRS, my 25 years experience as a CPA may very well help you in these times of uncertainty. Stop worrying and start learning about what options you have. If you just want to talk to someone about your IRS debt or want specific advice, I invite you to call me at 602-625-3074. That is 602-625-3074. And when you call, ask for me, Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor.
Hello, I'm Jessica Olson, and I'm here to introduce you to someone whose job it is to stand together with you at the worst of times. Life throws us unexpected curveballs, including losing loved ones, caretaking, troubled retirements, job losses, and legal settlements. Meet certified financial planner Larry Moscat, who pioneered crisis financial counseling. With a background as a clinical psychology practitioner, Larry has helped numerous people see through their crises to a brighter financial future. Larry?
Thank you, Jessica. At our firm, RII Advisors in North Scottsdale, we know terrible times don't usually last, but the effects of anxiety-infused financial decisions can last a lifetime. For 30 years, our prime goal has been to introduce freedom from fear and a feeling of financial security for our clients. We then move forward with safety and best-case outcome results when it comes to the financial decisions made during the worst of times.
To learn more, log on to www.RIIAdvisors.com. That's RIIAdvisors.com for information on how to get help. Once again, that's RIIAdvisors.com for financial counseling during life's most challenging times.
And welcome back to Understanding Autism. I'm Kim Isaac. I'm a co-host of this radio show. And with me, I have, with me over the phone waves, I have Paul Loudon, our other co-host. And
hello
we
there.
Also have a very we also have a very special guest with us, Dr. Jim Adams. He is the director at ASU's Autism and Asperger's Research Program. And today he's sharing information with us about the latest autism research. And so, Dr. Adams, do you want to share a little bit more? I know you brought up so many topics. What would you like to move on to next?
Let me mention just some highlights from our latest treatment study for children and adults with autism. It's a large study. We started with 60-some families. Half of them started a 12-month treatment study, and then half of them promised to wait and not make any changes. So they were a control group. and then they've been waiting 1 year, and then they just started the treatment study as well. It's a combination of six different nutritional treatments, so vitamin mineral supplements, fish oil, Epsom salt baths, carnitine, which helps build energy, digestive enzymes, because many kids and adults with autism don't digest food well, and then a healthy gluten-free, casein-free diet. And what we found was that of the families who finished the study, there were a lot of good benefits. Many of the families saw reductions in their child's or individual symptoms. Not huge, but I'd say some significant reductions, about 20% overall reduction in symptoms. What was really interesting is that IQ scores went way up. Nonverbal IQ scores in the treated group went up by 9 points, which is huge, and almost no change in the untreated group. So we saw some big improvements in cognition, too. And so we saw improvements in energy, less hyperactivity, less sensory problems, just a lot of good benefits overall. Again, not enough to cure, but certainly enough to provide some benefit with some healthy and inexpensive interventions.
Were these improvements linear, where sort of independently of where they might fall on the spectrum, they all moved up, or was it sort of the more severe the symptoms, the stronger the improvements, or anything like that?
We're still analyzing the data, but my impression is that it seems to be helpful to both some who are more severe and also to some who were on the milder side of the spectrum. It seemed to be helpful to both groups. The three treatments that seemed to be the most helpful, according to the families, were the vitamin mineral supplement, the fish oil, and the healthy gluten-free, casein-free diet. We had three very special cases of improvement in that study. We had one young girl, about 10 years old, who at the start of the study was physically very weak. She couldn't lift herself up off of the floor. She could only walk a short distance before she had to rest in her wheelchair. She just had very low energy. Once she started the carnitine, which is a special supplement that helps increase energy in the body, we believe, was very carnitine deficient, because the main source of carnitine for most people is beef and pork, and she didn't eat any of those, just absolutely had refused them for years. And so we think that's why she was physically so weak. And within a month of starting treatment, her energy level improved a lot. Soon she was walking around, even running, skipping, and the family put the wheelchair away in storage. So just one of several wonderful success stories.
That's amazing. I'm just like, that's amazing. I mean, what a gift for her to be feeling that much better. I can't even imagine not, you know, feeling like I can do some of those basic things that we do every day. I have two questions that I wanted to ask you. One is, you just mentioned that beef and pork were high sources of that. You said L-carnitine. Am I saying that right? I hope.
Yeah, of L-carnitine. Okay. They're almost the only way to get them. Your body can make some, but the only source in the diet is mostly beef, and there's some in pork, and there's almost none in any other food. So if you're not eating
really
beef and pork, if you're not eating beef or pork 2 to 3 times a week, and if you're feeling low in energy, and it's not just physical energy, but it affects mental function too. She was also not just physically impaired, but also mentally very, very affected, and the family began to see some improvements in mental function too.
That's great. I need to see. I don't eat beef or pork. That's why I was asking. I was kind of wondering. Maybe I need to get some supplements, too. But the other thing I wanted to ask you about was, you mentioned Epsom salt baths. And I was just curious, what does that do, and how often do you have to take them?
Sure. Epsom salt baths have been used for hundreds of years for minor aches and pains. Epsom salts are magnesium sulfate. And it turns out that many kids with autism are very low in sulfate. And sulfate is the fourth most common mineral in your body. Calcium's number one, and sulfate's number four. And although sulfate deficiency is pretty rare, most kids with autism are low in sulfate. And Epsom salt baths, just putting the Epsom salts into warm bath water and soaking twice a week is enough to significantly raise sulfate levels.
Oh, that's so interesting. So it raises sulfate levels. Does it do anything else?
Yeah, sulfate is important for many things in the body. It helps detoxify a wide variety of substances. It also helps deactivate neurotransmitters in the brain. It also helps lubricate the GI tract. It coats the GI tract. And so for kids who have constipation, part of the problem could be a lack of sulfate.
Wow, that is so interesting. Paul, do you have any thoughts you want to add?
Actually, I did have a question. It's sort of inspired by a question that's posted on our Facebook. I was wondering, in the course of these tests, in this test about nutrition and other tests, and all the tests really that you've been overseeing or reading about or paying attention to, have you seen sort of any medically significant difference between higher functioning and lower functioning individuals? Is there, you know, signs that different parts of the spectrum have different or are likely to have different needs in terms of nutrition or in terms of other medical conditions? Or does it look like autism really is, in a physical sense, one big thing that affects people to different degrees depending on sort of how badly off they are?
Yeah. The problem is that most studies don't have enough numbers in the mild group, the Asperger's group, to say for sure. Even our study with 60-some people, we don't have enough to say for sure yet. We're still doing the analyses. But overall, I'd say it seems mostly a matter of degree, that the differences are probably just worse in the more severe part of the spectrum and either in milder in the Asperger higher functioning side of the spectrum. But there doesn't seem to be any clear hard-cut difference that differentiates the two groups. It's just sort of a continuous part of one spectrum.
That was mostly what I was wondering, yeah. I mean, with the DSM-5 coming out and rearranging so that Asperger's is rolled back into autism, which honestly is sort of where I felt it was all along anyway, I was just wondering if, you know, from the medical side, if there seemed to be distinction between the disorders or if they just sort of seem to be degrees of the same disorder. And I think you've more or less answered my question, so thank you.
Yeah, we think part of it too is the intellectual ability, and that's why we're so excited in this study to see a big increase in intellectual functioning just from good nutrition, and we think that's very hopeful.
That was a great question, Paul. That was a really good question, because I actually had thought about that in the past, and I never really followed through on seeking out the answer. So that's really interesting. Do you think at some point that it would be of interest to try to sort of separate the groups by degrees of severity, or do you think that wouldn't really, you know, be a big deal to do?
No, we certainly are trying to do that, and we'll continue to try to look at the analyses. Again, for most cases, it just seems to sort of blur together. But there may be some differences that we haven't found yet that differentiate one group and another. So we're trying to search for that. I think also one of the symptoms we found, which is very interesting, is that there are a number of kids out there with what's called pica. They eat a lot of non-food items. And it's been suspected for a while that that's often due to nutritional deficiencies. So the child's eating sand, dirt, newspaper, paint, whatever. We think it's because there's something missing in their diet. And we had one very striking case of a boy who had severe pica for years. And then within 1 week of starting the healthy, gluten-free, casein-free diet, within 1 week, his pica was totally gone. He was just cured from it. And so it was exciting to see.
Wow, and did you say in 1 week?
Yeah, in just 1 week of starting a healthy diet, that whatever was missing in his diet, it made just a huge difference.
Oh, that's amazing.
We had one, Yeah, we had one other very striking case of a young adult man who for years had been unable to urinate on his own. So several times a day he had to be catheterized. So it was a very invasive procedure to have to do several times a day for years. And as soon as he started a dairy-free diet, within 4 days he fully regained the ability to urinate, a huge benefit to him. And that lasted for quite a while until one day, by mistake, a family member gave him some ice cream. He lost the ability for 4 days and then regained it, lasted again for a while, until one day at school someone gave him, by mistake, a slice of cheese pizza, and again, lost the ability to urinate for 4 days, restarted the and then within 4 days he was back to normal functioning again. So this young man and his family are just so thrilled. It's helped him so much socially. Just his quality of life is dramatically better. So you see something like that with a simple diet, and it really makes you think there's a lot more to it. And in fact, there's been a recent study by another group that shows many kids with autism have antibodies to gluten and casein. So it's just more evidence that for some individuals, the gluten-free, casein-free diet really can make a difference. Not for all of them, but for a good percentage.
How would the dairy affect somebody's bladder like that? I mean, what connection does that have?
Yeah, we don't know for sure. Our best guess is that it was inflammation, that it was just an allergic reaction occurring in a very strange way. He'd been investigated for years by doctors. They could never find any cause, and they had no hope of treatment for it. They told him he'd just have it the rest of his life, and they were just shocked when he was cured by the simple diet.
Wow, that is encouraging. I actually wanted to ask you, just hearing about all these nutritional, you know, things that are just amazing, obviously they're doing healing work. There's been some talk a little bit about, you know, medications and drugs and things that are being developed, and I don't know much about it, but I would think that these natural things are really focused on the healing that needs to take place. I'm not sure what the drugs are intended to do, but do you know anything about that?
Well, certainly our group is very focused mostly looking at nutritional treatments first, because we think they're going to be a lot safer. I'll give you an example. We've been doing a lot of research on seizures, and for most cases, we don't really know the causes of seizure, but we did a huge national study with almost 1,000 families to find out what treatments they thought were helpful. And so we looked at about 30 different drugs that are used to treat seizures, and we could eventually find the four that were best based on the family's responses, what four were most effective at treating seizures and caused the least problems. But even the best four drugs were still causing some worsening of mood, some worsening of language, some worsening of cognition. That used long term, they had some drawbacks. And then we looked at what other treatments were helpful. We looked at another 30 or so natural treatments, and it turns out there's a special diet that's been used for 70 years for treating seizures. It's called a ketogenic diet, just a very high-fat diet. And that seemed to work almost as well controlling seizures, but instead of worsening symptoms, it improved them. It improved language, improved mood, improved behavior. And so we're now hoping to do a research study on a modified form of that diet that's better tolerated, where it's both high protein and high fat, it's just low in carbs. And there's been 19 studies of it for seizures, and we hope to try it for children with autism and seizures. So that's sort of a long-winded answer to your question, that I think there's a lot of room still for nutritional interventions. And there may be some medications out there that are useful too, but I think we'll have much lower side effect profile if we start with the nutritional interventions.
Right. Okay, well, I actually have some questions about seizures, but why don't we take another short break, And when we come back, we'll continue our discussion with Dr. Jim Adams, the director of ASU's Autism and Asperger's Research Program, and we'll be right back.
Hello, I'm Jessica Olson, and I'm here to introduce you to someone whose job it is to stand together with you at the worst of times. Life throws us unexpected curveballs, including losing loved ones, caretaking, troubled retirements, job losses, and legal settlements. Meet certified financial planner Larry Moscat, who pioneered crisis financial counseling. With a background as a clinical psychology practitioner, Larry has helped numerous people see through their crises to a brighter financial future. Larry?
Thank you, Jessica. At our firm, RII Advisors in North Scottsdale, we know terrible times don't usually last, but the effects of anxiety-infused financial decisions can last a lifetime. For 30 years, our prime goal has been to introduce freedom from fear and a feeling of financial security for our clients. We then move forward with safety and best-case outcome results when it comes to the financial decisions made during the worst of times.
To learn more, log on to www.RIIAdvisors.com. That's RIIAdvisors.com for information on how to get help. Once again, that's RIIAdvisors.com for financial counseling during life's most challenging times.
At Beer and Bomb and Spean PC, we want to help you work on your business, not in your business. We take a simple approach. You know your business. Our firm gives you the information to make those decisions better. Our firm takes a proactive approach to your accounting needs. And if you look behind the numbers, you'll find there are hidden opportunities that we try to impart on you. Communication is the key to that understanding, and there is no charge for brief phone calls. Contact us at 602-266-5633 or email us at mitch@jfbpc.com. Birnbaum and Spean works to increase your understanding of your business in order to make the decisions necessary to move your business forward.
Ridenour, Heinten & Lewis is a multi-practice law firm, ideally equipped to assist with a broad range of legal and business issues, corporate and financial transactions, real estate, commercial, litigation, bankruptcy, and private client practice. Ridenour, Heinten & Lewis is a law firm that bases its practice on understanding the businesses of their clients. And they use this insight to meet each client's unique and evolving legal challenges. Call or click today, 602-254-9900. Find them on the web at rhkl-law.com.
Do you owe money to the IRS? Have you heard of possible payment options such as a partial payment installment agreement, offering compromise, or not currently collectible status? Knowing that you have options and what those options are will greatly relieve your worry and stress. Hi, my name is Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. If you are curious as to what options may be available to you if you owe money to the IRS, my 25 years experience as a CPA may very well help you in these times of uncertainty. Stop worrying and start learning about what options you have. If you just want to talk to someone about your IRS debt or want specific advice, I invite you to call me at 602-625-3074. That is 602-625-3074. And when you call, ask for me, Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor.
Welcome back to Understanding Autism. We were just talking about research with Dr. Jim Adams, the director of ASU's Autism and Asperger's Research Program. And I actually had a question about seizures, which is, you know, lately I've been hearing about people, actually like young adults on the spectrum, who didn't have seizures when they were young, but who are developing seizures now, just randomly out of the blue. And I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on that, if you were seeing that that's been rising or if that's common.
That's actually very common, that some children do develop seizures early on, but also around adolescence and sometimes even to an adulthood. So by the time individuals with autism become adults, typically around 20 to 30% of them will develop obvious seizures. And then also we know that about 60% or so, even if they don't have obvious seizures, they have abnormal electrical activity in the brain that would show up on an EEG that's probably interfering with thinking and memory and cognition. So we think seizure issues are very important to treat, especially because seizures are one of the leading causes of death for people with autism. Not necessarily the seizure, but the accidents that can occur when someone's having a seizure. And so we think this is very important to look into treating, and that's why we're looking at these studies.
Is there something that somebody can do to have a greater, you know, like a prediction that their child may be at risk for developing seizures, or is it just kind of a sudden onset?
There's often very little warning that a child's going to develop a seizure, but families of kids with autism should be aware that certainly there's an increase around puberty, but it also can occur later in life. And that's why we think some of the treatments that we're looking at, some of the treatments for seizures, like diets that are high in fats and meats but low in carbohydrates, maybe shifting to those diets early would help prevent the risk of seizures. We don't know, but that's a pretty reasonable guess. On our website, we've put three articles for families about seizures. One is just a simple overview, a consensus report that we co-authored with a number of experts around the country just to give some basic advice to families. And then there's another one that's our survey results of what families felt were the most helpful treatments for seizures. And then there's a handout based on research studies. There's surprisingly few research studies on what treatments actually work for seizures. So a lot of the medications that are given, there's never been a research study showing it helps seizures in autism. Or in some cases, the research has been done and shows it isn't helpful. And so there's a rating for every seizure treatment, A, B, C, or D, as to whether there is research behind it or isn't. So families can go check up any medication or other treatment they want to try.
Okay, that's really helpful. Actually, can you share the website that you're referring to?
That's autism.asu.edu. And in a few weeks, there'll be another article on there, too. We had another paper on seizures just accepted, and it will be there soon.
Oh, that's great. That's a great resource. And we'll post that on our Facebook page as well. Paul, do you have anything you want to add at the moment?
Not at the moment, thanks, though. I'm just listening and learning.
Okay. I don't want to leave you out. It's so weird not having you in the studio. It's very uncomfortable for me, actually. Having you face to face here, but we have a little bit more time, and Dr. Adams, maybe you can share with us, another development in research.
Yeah, well, maybe one of the things I could do is just mention something that's going on at ASU, not quite in the research side, but we've created an Asperger's class for students with Asperger's here at ASU. So any student at ASU who's on the autism or Asperger's spectrum can sign up and take a one-credit class where they meet with other students on the spectrum. They read a book called Aquamarine Blue that's a collection of short stories of people on the spectrum in college and their experiences. So they'll read one story and then discuss it in class, and then from there they can go and talk about their own experiences. So this has been a very popular class with our students. It really helps them get to know other students on the spectrum and feel, I think, much better about themselves. So that's been very popular, and we hope to expand on that.
That's a great idea for our class. What kind of professor leads it? Is it somebody who specializes in autism or counseling?
Yeah, it's led by the director of our counseling group for the Disability Resource Center. He said that the ASPEs were about 3% of his caseload, but about 20% of his workload. They just had so many challenges fitting into college. And so rather than trying to counsel them one-on-one, what he found is just much more helpful and much more efficient to have this small class instead. And we've been talking with another community college. We believe Mesa Community College will implement this a version of this class this coming January.
That's great. I love that idea. I think it's great. It builds community, and it does maximize the resources, you know, the energy of the helpers and even with the students. I mean, I think, actually, I have to say, though, I don't know. Some people may feel comforted by knowing other people have those same challenges, and others may not be fazed. I remember Paul and I had a talk one time, and I attempted at being comforting on some level, and he's like, yeah, that does nothing for me. But for the people that it does, I think it would be nice. I know for me that I would like to know that I wasn't the only one having, you know, certain kinds of problems, and, you know, just being able to you know, and learn from others too. So that's great. Did you start that class? Like, were you involved in putting it together?
No, I was not involved in starting it. It was started by our disability resource coordinator. But then the students liked being together so much, they went on to form their own club here at ASU, ASPEs at ASU. So now it's a new student organization, and they are active in doing a number of events with one another.
That's great. How many students are in that class, do you know? Or in the group and in the
class? They keep the class size small to around 10 or so students, but sometimes we've had multiple sections of it. So we hope that class will be offered again at ASU this spring. We'll wait and see.
That's great. Well, you know, I also, Paul, do you have anything? Sorry, I don't want to skip over you. Do you have anything you want to ask or share?
No, I'm just listening. Sorry.
Okay. No, I just want to be sure because I can't see you. So if you're waiting to jump in, I have no idea. But I actually wanted to bring up, too, one of my favorite things, actually, I look forward to it every year, is the upcoming annual Zoo Walk for Autism Research. And so I was hoping, Dr. Adams, that you could share a little bit about this event.
Sure. It's our ninth annual event coming up. Every year, several thousand families show up. The great thing about walking around the zoo is it's appropriate for all ages, all ability levels. The young kids love to run around in the wide pathways. We've seen grandparents in wheelchairs. It's just very inviting for families to come. They can do the walk around the zoo and see lots of signs about autism along the way. And then after the walk, then they can stay at the zoo the rest of the day for free if they want to. That's just included as part of registering and coming to the walk. It is a fundraiser, and it supports a lot of the research that we do here at ASU, but it's also just a lot of fun. A lot of families really enjoy it. And in fact, this year's T-shirt design, we just had our art contest, and we had a wonderful submission by a 21-year-old man in Mesa, Arizona, with autism, and he presented a great design that we'll send out an email about very soon. It's a wonderful picture of a bird, multicolored phoenix, rising up, and it's titled Rising Above Autism. So it's just a very powerful picture.
Yeah, it sounds like very positive and uplifting, and that's one of the things I really enjoy about the walk is just the community. There's such a, you know, like an enthusiasm and a positive support feel to the whole thing. And I've always enjoyed going. And actually, Paul came last year for the first time.
I'll be back this year.
Yeah, we're excited. And, of course, our team is dedicated to raising as much money as we can to support this research. And we'll post information on our Facebook page on how you can support. And if you want to join our team, we would love that. And let me think here for a second. I wanted to make sure that we got the ZooWalk in our talk, and we do have a few more minutes left. So is there any final thoughts you want to share, Dr. Adams, about something we can look forward to in the future for research?
Sure. We just finished a study looking at gut bacteria in kids with autism. Most people have about 1,000 different types of bacteria in their gut, and that helps you in a lot of ways to digest food and help protect you against bad bacteria. But it turns out kids and adults with autism have about 20% fewer types of bacteria, and they're especially missing a few beneficial types. So we're now in the midst of planning a couple research studies to look at special probiotics that can help restore some of those abnormal gut bacteria and help really improve a lot of the GI problems that people have seen. And what's exciting is we're working with a group at Caltech that has an animal model, and they've shown that with a particular bacteria in these animals, they're able to not only restore normal healthy gut function, remove a lot of the inflammation, there's actually a big improvement in cognition and in behavior as well. So it's the gut has big effects on the rest of the body, and so we're very excited about that.
That is very exciting. Actually, I've been hearing more about that recently, just in general in the health world, is people, I don't think they realize the power in the gut, the gut has over different systems in the body. Do you want to talk just a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's been very unexplored because up till now we've been limited to culture methods where people could only look at 10 or 20 or 30 types of the bacteria in the gut. But now with these new DNA-based methods, we can look at 1,000 or so. We're discovering many of these bacteria we don't even have names for yet. That's how new it is. But they seem to be very important. If you have certain types of bacteria, they help protect you against a bad bacteria that can cause some really nasty gut problems. And also can irritate the GI tract and cause a lot of pain in the stomach as well, and can affect your ability to absorb good nutrients into the body. So we think that by treating the gut, we hope that with these beneficial bacteria, we hope we'll see not just improvements in diarrhea and constipation and other GI problems, but we hope to see a lot of behavioral improvements and even intellectual gains as well.
That just makes so much sense to me, you know, because, again, like somebody who maybe doesn't even know they're not feeling well, I mean, on the cellular level, obviously the changes are being made, but, you know, in terms of somebody being available to learn, you know, and to understand what's going on around them, if they're distracted by their bodies not feeling right or, you know, operating right, that would be a huge obstacle to them, you know, learning in the most efficient, you know, optimal way that they can.
Right. I mean, imagine how distracted you are if you're just feeling hungry, letting alone if you're feeling pain in your gut as well. So, yeah, we hope that's just one of several areas we want to look at in this coming year.
I think that's great. And I'm particularly, I think, sensitive to it for some of the people that that are nonverbal. Because I often wonder, you know, sometimes emotion on their faces doesn't always show the same way that ours would. And, you know, if they can't verbally communicate, I always wonder, you know, how they're feeling inside, not just from an emotional standpoint, but just a physical standpoint, you know, and you never really know. So it's really great that these kinds of, you know, treatments and understandings are available for people to go explore for their kids. Because it's absolutely worth looking into, especially for those that can't really express how they're feeling.
Yeah, I think especially for those kids, as you say, who aren't verbal, and if they may be, for example, are pounding their head, well, it's very possible they have a migraine headache and their head just hurts, but they don't have the language to explain it, whereas a simple aspirin might make a huge difference. And so if we can try to figure out what are some of the physical symptoms that are causing these unusual behaviors, because these behaviors have a reason. There's a reason the individual might be hitting themselves or hurting themselves. And if we can try to understand that and help heal the body, we hope we'll be able to give them a much higher quality of life.
That's great. Thank you so much. We're actually at the end of the show. Thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate it. I learned a lot, and I know our listeners have too. And I'm hoping that you'll come back again.
Absolutely. Thanks so much to both of you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Dr. Adams. Okay, everybody, so check out our Facebook page. We're going to post information about the Zoo Walk and some research articles, and we will see everybody tomorrow for another episode of Understanding Autism.